The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky. Last week, we dedicated the show to a discussion of what's commonly called the right to be forgotten, or in fact, to be delisted from search. So this week, we've decided to discuss the flip side of that issue, the right to be remembered. A few weeks ago, the chief internet evangelist of Google, Vince Cerf, warned that we face losing all our records of the 21st century in a digital dark age.
So the issue here is not just the physical bits, but what do they mean? If you use a program, for example, to create a spreadsheet, you have a complex file. You store the file away and you hold on to it for 20 or 30 years. And even pretending you could read the disk again, do you have the software that knows what the bits mean? So the digital vellum idea is not just physical medium, but an ecosystem which is able to remember what bits mean over long periods of time. And we're talking centuries to thousands of years.
Vince Cerf there in a recent BBC interview explaining the risk of holding vital information in very temporal digital format. But how likely is a digital dark age, so-called, in reality? And what can we do to preserve our data from this digital black hole? Joining me in the studio from our crack tech team, is Samuel Gibbs. Samuel, welcome, crack tech team.
Hello.
That's right. You wrote a piece responding to Vince Cerf's doomsday prophecies. So we'll be talking a little bit about that later. Julia Powles is also joining us. And Julia, you are our resident rights expert. You were here with us last week. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
And we'll also be joined by scientist Lewis Dartnell, author of How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. Not for the preppers, we'll talk about that later, to get his take on retaining essential knowledge in the digital age. And I take a trip just down the street to the British Library to meet the head of their web archive, Helen Hawkshoe, to get a professional archivist's view on the long game. But first, a Tech Weekly first, I think. Julia Powles, you are going to start our conversation on a poetic note.
Indeed. So I've found a quite beautiful analogy through this overstated right to be forgotten debate, and it comes from a poem, a lesser known work of T.S. Eliot in 1940s London. It was a commissioned work for the rebuilding the churches, and if you take away the more spiritual note, it's about rebuilding knowledge in what he calls, "O wretched generation of enlightened men, betrayed on the mazes of your ingenuities, engaged in futile speculation and unconsidered action." His appeal is that, forgetful, you neglect your shrines and churches. And he says, "The endless cycle of idea and action, endless invention, endless experiment, brings knowledge of motion but not of stillness, knowledge of speech but not of silence. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?"
Thank you very much, Julia. Dr. Lewis Dartnell is an astrobiologist and research fellow at the University of Leicester, as well as a noted science writer. But actually, Lewis, we're not talking to you about either of those things today, even though in the lab, your research involves understanding how microbial life survives the bombardment of cosmic radiation. So in some way, we are kind of talking about how we survive, indeed, in our physical and microbial bodies. But you also think about how humans can survive shocks to the system, right? And whether that's an apocalyptic event or the internet going down, how we retain essential knowledge and rebuild ourselves after such an event. Welcome to the podcast. First off, I want to focus on this Vince Cerf pronouncement, yeah, as it were. Do you think that this dark age that he describes does actually pose a real risk?
I think so. I think Vince Cerf has brought up a very interesting point here, or at least the threat of something that could transpire. So we're not exactly in this dark age yet, because we are preserving our photos on Facebook and we've still got our emails on the servers. But if there is some kind of issue or Facebook goes down for whatever reason, then we do risk losing a lot of this personal heritage. And I think for all of us, that would be a big issue. And as I was writing about in the article, it's, you know, kind of perhaps losing the photos of your firstborn child or the, you know, a photo of your wife before she was killed in a car crash or something. These are really significant moments in your life that you could risk losing forever because these memories, these photographs don't exist as physical objects anymore. We take them on a digital camera, upload them to Facebook, and that's all it's ever been, is just, you know, ones and zeros on the internet somewhere.
Now, that's interesting when you think about something like a digital legacy. And in fact, there's an entire industry that is cropping up behind, you know, preserving those elements that the photographs that initially would have been in a shoebox underneath the bed.
Yeah.
Now it's about, you know, our Flickr photos or our Facebook photos. So there actually is an industry that's growing up around this. But it's not just our personal histories that Vint is talking about. He's talking about our cultural identity, isn't he?
Well, exactly. It's the not just the personal, it's the kind of cultural or societal as well. And this isn't just, I say, kind of images and maybe kind of emails. If they get lost, then how can historians come back to our age and piece together the story, or someone who only transpires to be an important maybe after their death and, you know, their email server might have been wiped. That is lost forever. It's not like, as you say, you have a shoebox full of old letters and postcards and love letters that you can piece together their life. It's this societal information that we risk losing as well. And I think a kind of an interesting side point here as well is things like music we risk losing. So a lot of these recordings predate the digital age. They're on, you know, kind of reel-to-reel magnetic tapes and things. And these, the physical media is deteriorating and degrading. And these things, this music is literally flaking off and being destroyed. So
you raise an example of this in the article that you wrote on The Guardian about somebody who's actually in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but whose recordings are disappearing.
Yeah, this is the story of Huddy William Leadbetter, or Leadbelly. And he's been hugely influential throughout the history of music, with people like Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash and Led Zeppelin, the Chili Peppers and Nirvana. Like, these standout bands have all covered the songs from this same musician, who was known as the king of the 12-string guitar. But what's kind of depressing and crushing about this example is we've got the descendants of that music. We've still got recordings of the covers, but we've lost a lot of that original material. It's been lost and degraded from the original recordings. And that's one great example of what we risk losing. But now imagine multiplying that amongst all of our cultural heritage. I say of the kind of images and photographs and sound recordings, not just music, but recordings of languages which are now dying out, or animals which are now extinct. These are, I say, quite profound things that could be lost forever.
Is it so important, though? I mean, imagine people write that, you know, history is written by the winners. Is this, you know, history now is written by the people who have the most, I don't know, it's a little
biggest
bit less romantic, biggest hard disks or most convertible formats.
But I suppose the important point is here, we don't know what will turn out to be important.
We never have.
But we risk losing everything. So you might have had a very famous novelist who died, and then all of the letters were lost in a house fire 5 years afterwards. That would be a crushing loss. But every novelist and every politician, we're not seeing a lot of this grey literature, you know, kind of political documents and you know, committee meeting. They might be stupendously boring. But if we're trying to track the progress of a political movement and you've lost all of that stuff that happened 10 years ago, how can you piece together the story afterwards?
Sam, you wrote the piece in The Guardian that was in response to this pronouncement. Do you think that perhaps, as the chief internet VP at Google, Google might be planning something in the preservation environment?
Well, they certainly haven't said anything yet. But Google's mission is to organize, basically catalogue, the world's information. That is their one, the prime directive, as it were. And they've gone about that in all sorts of ways, all the way down to Street View in their current mapping solutions, you know. So it wouldn't surprise me. They also come about from, if you look at their email solution, like Gmail, the whole premise of Gmail when it launched was you never have to delete an email. It's always there. You have enough space. I mean, they, at that stage, I remember, they launched with something like 9 gig of space, and this was the days when you had about 100 meg in an inbox, and it was like you constantly having to delete stuff. Now no longer. It wouldn't surprise me, although I'm not sure Vint Cerf is quite you know,
as dastardly.
Yes.
He does have the beard, though, to be fair.
He does indeed.
I mean, what do you think of this digital velum that Vint Cerf has described, Lewis? You know, are our present formats so brittle? Are we thinking ahead enough when it comes to how we're building the technologies that we're using every day now?
Well, I don't know a great deal, to be honest with you, about the technologies and the hardware that are being built now. Hard disks, as we've just been talking about, are fabulously high-density stores of information, but they're still susceptible to being wiped by magnetic fields. And what you don't want is have all of your eggs in one basket, and, you know, for kind of a server farm or something, to all go down with the power loss and that data to be wiped by some event. It's thinking of ways of how you can be redundant in your storage as well, not putting everything in one hard disk, but maybe having multiple hard disks. Or in the case of the music, maybe having one copy on hard disk, but also going back to physical media, you know, copying things onto cassettes, perhaps, or LPs. These are all alternatives.
I've just got rid of all my CDs, right? So now I'm suddenly thinking, oh my God, but then that throws in all kinds of interesting issues, Julie, about rights. If I've got all of my digital content on iTunes, as we've discussed on the podcast before, I can't then pass that down to my future generations who may wish to have my collection of monkeys memorabilia. Who knows? Maybe they won't. But, you know, so there's a rights issue as well with the preservation, the hoarding, frankly, of all of our digital ephemera, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's interesting that I think that the parallel, I mean, it's an interesting considering what we spoke about last week, the parallel between that and Vint Cerf championing preservation. It appeals to our personal vanity to have these collections, and I think that the risk is because, as Lewis said, we don't know what's going to matter. There's a hoarding mentality that takes over, and it comes to the concern that I think that sometimes we don't want this information to be redundant, stored in multiple places, and accessible by unknown powers beyond our lives, beyond our reach, and we need options so that people can themselves control what is memorialized about them as much as we can as a society reflect on what really matters.
It's just a gigantic pile of spaghetti, you know, and it just feels as if you solve one problem and then you throw up another one and a giant meatball rolls off the table and out the door.
I think an interesting point as well is, like, we all agree that kind of emails of prominent politicians or authors might end up being very important, but a lot of what we share culturally today is kind of chaff. It's like kind of lolcats and internet memes, and these are hugely important, and there are vloggers like Zoella who have millions of viewers. Is that significant? Would we try to start archiving all of her videos or other vloggers? You could argue, I think, quite convincingly that they are as influential on young people today as the Beatles were a generation before. So by that metric, we should store it all. But then where do you draw the line between these kind of things that come and go and things which are worth being preserved for prosperity?
Well, we actually, coming up later in this podcast, we do go to the British Library and speak to our British institution for how they are processing and archiving this information.
Yeah.
But in the article that you wrote, you describe prior attempts to capture the world's knowledge, as it were. You describe, I mean, this is not a hubris of our time. It's not as if, you know, here we are in the 21st century and we need to preserve ourselves and because we're the greatest. You know, people way back in the 1700s, people back in, you know, cave paintings, they thought they were the bomb, right? So what are some of the other ways that people have tried to preserve?
Yeah, so if we zoom out even further, not just from kind of personal ephemera like photos and emails, not just kind of cultural stuff like a body of music, but even to the kind of the sum total of human knowledge that civilization has accrued and accumulated up until now, that there are genuine attempts now to try to preserve kernels of this knowledge if the worst ever were to happen, if it to be some kind of catastrophe and survivors have to start again. What would be the knowledge you would need to reboot civilization from scratch? And there is nothing new about this idea. And as you're saying, back in the mid-1700s, when the encyclopedias were being compiled, people like Denis Diderot specifically considered their kind of duty, their responsibility, if you like, to try to preserve human knowledge in case Western civilization were to fall into darkness again. Because they were much more aware and kind of conscious back then that even great civilizations collapse and disappear, that the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Romans, and I think perhaps today we're a little bit too cocky about the invulnerability of our situation. I'm not saying the world is about to collapse. I hope it doesn't.
Good Lord, I know
But in the 1 million chance it does, we perhaps want to start putting some stuff in a save file in a safe place.
So just the other day, I was in London and I was at the Barbican and I went to the Magnificent Obsessions exhibition, which is about collections that artists have that are on display. And one of the artists had displayed an Encyclopedia Britannica set. And I have to say, I've always been obsessed with getting a full set from the year that I was born, because that is the sum of the world's knowledge at that particular point in time. Whereas now, of course, with Wikipedia, we don't have that sense of this is what we know now. We just have a kind of ongoing rolling understanding of this is what we know right now. Right now. So in some ways, aren't we actually going backwards because we don't have these snapshots of what we know?
If you really wanted, there is a service, where you can download and print Wikipedia in one go for the day you were born, if you wanted to.
It would be a lot of stuff.
The forest would wince. But if you want to do it for your baby born, you know, next week, you could, if you want to have this kind of monumental thing of printing Wikipedia of all that was known of about Brangelina on the day that your baby was born.
So tell me a little bit about how people have responded to this thought experiment that you did, which turned into the book.
Yeah, so talking specifically about the knowledge, which this thought experiment about, if you wanted to preserve these kernels, these seeds of human knowledge that then would expand and grow back into the tree of all we know today if the catastrophe came along. I've had some fascinating conversations with people about this concept, because obviously it's impossible. It's a conceit. At the end of the day, the knowledge is a science book about how our world works and what enabled civilization to progress as we developed.
Great MacGuffin.
But some people haven't really got that conceit. I'm taking it at face value. And I've had some very fascinating, I guess is the word, conversations with kind of preppers and survivalists.
Sam is just creased over here in the corner.
That I haven't spoken enough about kind of guns and how to skin a badge or something, which clearly is important information. And
volume 2.
Yeah, exactly, the knowledge 2.0.
More the knowledge, yeah. Exactly.
More of the same, exactly. So it's been a fun project, and I've learned an enormous amount doing it, and I hope when people read the knowledge, they might appreciate a bit more of all this stuff we just take for granted.
Because in truth, what we're talking about in digital preservation around this table and you know, in greater conversations that are happening here, there, and everywhere in libraries, etc., isn't just about forgetting and remembering, is it? It's more about the kind of the recorded moments, those personal identifiers, our cultural understanding, isn't it?
Yeah, but by thinking about what we value today in order to save for the future, it's more about living in the now. It's about opening up your eyes and being more aware of what is special about the time I'm living in now, and how has it been different from perhaps the 1960s or the 2060s, and therefore saving those things which are likely to change. Which, I say, is all about living in the moment, isn't it?
On that Zen note, thank you very much, Lewis Dartnell, for joining us here on Tech Weekly. From re-edited government websites to small sites falling off the grid, the web is as much a part of our cultural heritage as any other form of hard data. So, who is making efforts to preserve it? And how on earth can we make sense of the incredible quantity of data and content that we are archiving? One of the places in the UK that's doing this is the British Library, and their web archive is preserving millions of UK-based websites every day. So that's UK-based websites.uk websites. I headed down to the library to talk with Helen Hotchew, who is in charge of the web archive. And given that there is so much online about kittens and porn, we did get into that conversation. So I'm standing inside the British Library, which is actually a building that I adore. I haunt it. I live in one of the reading rooms. It is the largest library in the world, with about 170 million items from around the world in all kinds of languages. But it's essentially our national memory bank, holding personal collections, stamp archives, play scripts, prints. It's got my PhD thesis in here. But what's actually being done to preserve the web archive? The websites that we create, that we consume. So last April, following new regulations laid down by Parliament, the library announced that it would save all the nation's websites with a .uk suffix, as well as every British website, newsletter, ebook, and blog. Oh, it's huge to preserve the country's digital legacy. Enter Helen, who looks after the web archive here.
Okay, so my name is Helen Hawkshew. I'm head of web archiving at the British Library. What I do? I archive the web.
That's a huge task.
It is a daunting job if you think about how big the UK domain is. It's one of the largest top-level domains in the world. So we know that there are over 10 million .UK registrations.
I mean, all of this sounds like an enormous challenge, given that everything happens so quickly. It's not as if a domain stays static. Do you simply take a snapshot of the domain and then hope that it lasts for a given period of time? Or do you do like Google and create a spider and crawl the web for the latest version?
We use web crawlers to collect content like Google does, so a spider. But I think our purpose is slightly different because we are crawling, I think, more deeply. So once a year, we send out the crawler, go out and do a crawl of websites we identify or we know we have discovered.
And, I mean, obviously, the British Library, I've always thought of it, the building that I hang out in, as the tip of the iceberg. Because what I interact with is simply what's accessible to me. Beneath the ground, it practically goes to the core of the earth, doesn't it, with all of the collections? That's where everything's stored, isn't it? Except for the monumental centerpiece that you have in the lobby.
Yeah, that's the highlight. It's the building block of our future collections and our knowledge, this nation's heritage. So sometimes I think, despite the daunting figures, I think what we do is really interesting.
Is it housed here? Is it based in the London British Library?
There is a copy of all the legal deposit content here, but there are four, it's replicated four places for redundancy, but also as additional access points.
So will you take me to see the servers?
Yeah, we're going to have a look at the servers and later on perhaps also a tour of our archive. How about that?
Perfect. The nice thing about the British Library is that, even if I left a trail of breadcrumbs, I probably wouldn't have any idea where I've been, where I'm going. Get completely lost. I can really feel the hum, actually. That's quite an awesome feeling. It really, you can actually feel it. It's as if the air is compressed as you're walking through. Loud, and there are probably about 16 or 20 racks doubled up, gigantic pieces of power coming out of the sky and out and going back down into the ground in a relatively small room. But I believe that most of the servers for the digital archive are actually in the Boston Spa holding reserves. How do people access the web archive, Helen?
There are many ways of accessing the web archives. They are not accessible online because of the access requirements attached to the regulations. So they are only accessible within the six legal deposit libraries reading rooms.
And are there other web archives that aren't British Library that have access to the kind of content that the British Library accesses? What about, the Internet Archive? How do you interact with open archives?
Very good question, Alex. I think you hit the point there, because if you look at the web, which is a global thing, right? However, when we organize the archiving of it, we chop them into pieces, based on national boundaries, which really only exist in the loosest sense. Yeah, but nobody can take on the job of archiving the web. So we have to divide and conquer. However, when it comes to access, it becomes problematic. When you come into the library, you want to find out about something. It doesn't matter, where the website is hosted. We are fully aware of that. However, I think we have found a potential way of dealing with that problem. What I can do is to show you a service, which is part of our Open UK Web Archive, where you can search any URL. It will at least tell you which archive in the web archive in the world has how many copies of that particular URL.
Okay, Helen, now we're in your office. So this is where the web archive, the domain that you oversee, this is basically the throne room. can you talk me through some of the notable things that you've archived?
I thought I'd show you the one another website. This, I think, is the output, or the art project itself. In 2010, 2009, Anthony Gormley had a public art project on the fifth plinth at the Trafalgar Square. I don't know if you remember this. But when the project finished, he came to us. He said, I can't maintain this website forever. This needs to go to a place, a home. Can you archive it? And it contains about 2,000 hours of video. I have sit through most of these. And the most hilarious would be the one the guy proposed to the girlfriend on the plinth, and she liked it. She just walked away.
Amazing. So you've watched
quite a few of them.
This is literally the only record.
This is the only record.
And what was the very first thing that was archived on the web archive?
I think in our archive, it would be the British Library website.
That's nice and recursive, isn't it?
Yeah. So we recovered, reassembled this into the archive. So
what you have, wow, this is a bit like the Internet Archive. You've got a sort of snapshots of the British Library at bl.uk, which is the website here.
Taken over time.
So you've got, since 1995, it's a great sort of exploration, archaeological exploration into web design as well, whether, back in the day it was just simply white background and black text and moved into the slightly beige color and as it is today.
I think one of the additional benefits of a web archive in comparison with a live web is that it captures the evolution, the changes over time. And that is extremely interesting for historians and other scholars. So I want to show you something which is on the British Library website from 18th of April 1995. So that actually has one of the older audio formats. It's the recording of a nightingale.
That's absolutely lovely. And so that's the very first recording. And that's what we have from the very first thing that was archived in the web archive.
Yeah, the first Twitter on the web. If you like,
exactly.
Literally.
The first tweet.
Yeah.
The first tweet.
So I think it's really interesting in that I was actually quite surprised that some of the browsers actually can replay it.
In the past, people would have created things, whether it's diaries or photo albums or whatever, and not expected them to be archived. Before the legal deposit guidelines came in, mm-hmm. in 2013, you mm-hmm. asked permission. Now, of course, you don't ask permission. You sort of say, hey, British public, we're taking it. And ethically, how does that... Is there an ethical issue associated with that?
So when we go out and crawl websites, we actually identify ourselves. We explain why we visited someone's server. And there are, we embed a link to the relevant information about non-print legal deposits so that people understand why we visit their website and take copies in first place. When people don't agree that content have breaches data privacy and things like that, we have a whole list of circumstances under which we'll consider takedown of content. So doing these things and also making sure that content is collected in compliance with law, we hope that we can manage the consequences.
So does that mean that there is a lot of sex in the servers of the British Library? Because sex and kittens are the two things that come on the web very, very quickly. And is that a snapshot that we wish to have for future generations?
Yeah. So I'm sure they are in there because we don't select content to be excluded. So everything which is .uk will be picked up. Huh. I think what we want to do, our task is to collect content as it is. We actually take quite a neutral role here without judging what might be of value, how people might draw conclusion based on what they see. That's not our role. Our role really is quite neutral in this. It's just to keep a copy of what is out there on the web.
Many thanks to Helen Hawkshoe there. To learn more about the British Library and their web archive, go to bl.uk. Coming up, we turn to the thorny issue of personal archiving. How do you protect your digital legacy? But before that, a word from our sponsor.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
This month, Facebook updated its services to include a legacy contact, a person whom you nominate that can manage your account when you die. Increasingly, social media services and other big brands are putting in place means for people to manage how they're remembered in their digital lives. So how will the right to be remembered look in the coming decade? Sam, I want to come over to you first because you wrote this piece about Vint Cerf. How are people attempting to preserve themselves now?
Well, it's an interesting thing to look at because there's kind of three sections of self-preservation here in information and digital form. There's stuff on people's hard drives. That's pretty simple. Everything you accrue as you the Word documents you write or the music you create, the photos you shoot. Then there's the web services, which of course Google has a vested interest in because it wants to archive all your photos in its service or all your posts or your email, etc. And then you kind of have if people have taken the forethought, the redundant backups, normally off-site, hopefully off-site, potentially on a secondary hard drive. So there's this kind of like whole band of what's the best practice to make sure that the stuff you're creating or accruing can be passed on or even just survive, say, a fire or something like that.
But do people really need that sort of I've accepted the calendar invitation that you sent to me last Thursday?
There's a lot of it which I think is complete dross. Now, you know, who's to say what is dross and who is gold? Another man's garbage is platinum reclaimed from a mobile phone.
Very poetic.
see, the thing is, you from the point of view of, so I look at my own life, for instance. I shoot photos. I don't often look at them, but I shoot quite a lot of photos. Half of them are for work, and I don't really care about those. Once they're done their job, that's it, and they're archived on the Guardian servers, so I don't have to worry about those. But then I've got all the personal photos, the things of my family, of my friends, occasions. I've been to like 20 odd weddings in the last like 3 or 4 years, and I've got quite a lot of wedding photos. Now, from my point of view, is they're crucial, at least a few of them. Now, I may shoot 100, but I only really want 10. At the moment, I'm not filtering them out. I'm just stashing the whole lot. And I've got several different ways of doing that. One way that many people do is just to dump it on Facebook or another social networking site or Flickr, for instance, you know, something that takes photos. Now my view is that's great, but what happens if the service goes down? Now, you know, I'm not saying that Flickr is going to go under anytime soon, but Yahoo has a habit of destroying the good things that it has. So far, Flickr survived and under Marissa Mayer has flourished into a better service, you know, but they own the servers that your photos are stored on, and you're not generally speaking paying for it. So what is your right to the service staying as it is? And the same way with Google. I mean, Google makes money from you by advertising effectively, but you know, it's still providing a free service. You're not paying for this. Now, you know, Vint Cerf was talking about bit rot. Now, he was specifically talking about all the files and things we create that are locked into these kind of like archives that you may or may not be able to access at a later date. Now, you know, you could say, for instance, I'm writing my memoirs, right? And I use Microsoft Word, and I have been using Microsoft Word for the last 5 years. When I first started, all the files would have been saved in a .doc file. Now, that's a proprietary Microsoft file format, right? Now, say Microsoft decides that it doesn't want to support it anymore, and you know, things progress. I mean, since the first iteration of Word to now, the computers that would have run original Word, they're almost certainly dead. And the upgrade and the update cycle means that to embrace new technology, you have to basically reject some of the old stuff. And so, say, 20 years from now, there may be a situation where those .doc files, I have nothing to open them with. That's because the computer's knackered. The software that used to open them, I can't run anymore. And, I don't know, hopefully we're going to hit quantum computing, which is a whole nother level. Is Microsoft Windows going to even run on? I don't know. Anyway, but there is a solution to this. It's basically embracing more open formats. And I think that's something that's really turned around in the last, like, 5 years. We've seen governments start to embrace open file formats. Now, for the user, it's a case of just choosing the right program. Once you've got an open file format, there's no detriment to supporting it in the future. So, for instance, say, oh no, your photo's in JPEG, right? They're also, that's what a standard camera normally captures them in. Now, the JPEG is based upon a whole system of, intellectual property, I guess. But it's an open, license-free format at the moment, and it is likely to stay that way in perpetuity. So there's no detriment to future imaging processes building this in. You know, but if you happen to use something, I don't know, a proprietary image format, say from Nikon, for instance, and Nikon goes bust or demands lots of money, then you're no longer going to be open these. So what do we do? And that's what Vint Cerf was talking about.
And it's interesting, you know, these are some of the technological aspects. You know, this is about the degradation, the bit rot. I think that's quite a handy term to use. But ultimately, what we're talking about, what we have spoken about thus far in the podcast, is we've spoken about archiving our collective knowledge, our cultural knowledge. Here, Julia, we're talking about our personal knowledge. It's my access to the JPEGs. It's my access to the docs that hold my memoirs. Is this something that we should really be considering, or should we, as Lewis suggested earlier in the podcast, should we just be really zen about it and just live in the now, man, and write everything on papyrus?
Well, I think there's, in what we've been discussing, there's a rights issue, absolutely. And then there's a sort of software hardware issue. And we have to remain aware that in the software hardware issue, there's two big camps in technology between open and closed. And Google is of the open mindset. It advocates open software, search. It is having quite a lot of difficulty with the move to mobile and the fact that now we have closed ecosystems. The open environment offers many advantages. It also offers some disadvantages, and the primary one, it normalizes a culture of collecting everything, a perpetual present. And there is no freedom without the freedom to resist. And I think the concern, if we move to an ever more open world where we are zen and we let everything is out there, very interestingly, one of the biggest critics of the right to be forgotten we spoke about is the ex-GCHQ director, who made a statement that, well, everything is out there now, so you can't control it. We're better off controlling use. And I think that we really need to think about what we do at the level of access at the beginning, and the fact that it should be up to us whether we do preserve those photos or those memories for ourselves and for those that come after us.
I think as well we also have to think about those people who choose to not use technologies to record themselves.
Absolutely.
There are some people who are very active at preserving themselves and broadcast themselves and you know, selfies every 5 minutes. And I've done, you know, a photo a day as I was going through the painful tail end of my research. I took a photo every day just to remind myself that in fact I was still alive. Thank goodness they're out there, because I can say, okay, this is, I'm referencing where I was then and comparing where I am now. But then there are those people who just simply choose to not engage. What happens to those people? Will we have black holes there? Or in fact, will they be the only people who are remembered when in fact the cataclysmic event happens and the internet turns off?
I mean, you could see it from the point of view of when we look back into history, this is exactly what has happened. We've only picked up the letters and the things of important people who might have stored it. I mean, for instance, the letters of, say, a servant way back when, they would not have been saved unless perhaps
unless they got married to somebody later on who happened to be, you know, an important person, in quotes.
I mean, the argument here is that everybody is important. I'm not necessarily that's true. Not in the annals of history. In the now, yes. Tomorrow, perhaps not.
At a cultural level, we have experienced this type of thing. In the 1930s, the mass observation movement, you know, was about actually capturing everyday lives. And if you look even further back at things like, you know, diaries that were kept by people, servants who then ended up marrying somebody who was, you know, who was an important person, we are very thankful for having that personal record of what everyday life was for that individual, because it gave us a sense of what life was like. How would you curate the great unwashed people who use the internet? How would you identify who is important to preserve and who is not important to preserve?
That is the golden question. I mean, I honestly don't even know where you would start. You could look at the journalists. We always went, so in ye olden times, you know, we'd had newspaper archives going back way back, you know, and they were all kept in binders and things like that, and they still are today. But, you know, now, for instance, The Guardian publishes, I don't know, 600 things a day, and only 60 make it into paper. What about the other lot? I mean, is that as important as the stuff that goes into the paper? You know, as a technology journalist, I would say yes, perhaps even more so. But you know, where do you draw the line? Now, I think we're going to be historians looking back on this, unless they've got some amazing algorithmic filters, are just going to be, you know, like looking for the needle in the haystack. No idea. Sorry,
Julia. Do you have any idea how we can sort of dissect this quite thorny issue, this pufferfish, if I wish to go down that analogy of thorns?
What I worry is that you hinted at it, that because we have a collected all culture, that it's where things go dark that people look most. And there's actually, to me, some of the most concerning services and reactions that people have are services that track, for example, when tweets are deleted. And that tweet might be deleted because a moment later you thought, actually, that was a bit inconsiderate.
Or you made a spelling mistake.
Yeah,
and the fact that those are captured and sort of used against people because you said this, therefore you should stand by your word. I think that as we live more and more in a recorded world, the kind of sentiment that I was educated with of, oh, we'll never put in writing something you wouldn't be prepared to say, you know, in front of your mother or whatever, is a bit difficult because so much of our communication is mediated technologically, and it's going in a way that we almost can't avoid. As we get to a totally ubiquitous computing environment, everything is going to be recorded in some way, and I think that requires us to think very carefully about whether we are a record by default or a control by default sort of society. Who really has the ultimate decision-making power of how we express ourselves and preserve ourselves?
There's a psychological phenomenon that is experienced in many of these services in that we don't actually understand that something is being recorded. We don't actually understand that what we're tweeting or what we're writing is in fact public. We may understand sort of intellectually, but we forget in the moment because it is so instantaneous, and we just think, oh, I can't conceive of the hundreds of millions of people who could potentially be reading this. And you know, I argue
we shouldn't necessarily have to, if we're in a very normal, spontaneous, ephemeral sort of conversation, that we shouldn't have to worry about how this could be used against us.
But is it something that will always be used against us, or must we think about how it will be used against us? I mean, it seems to me that that's a quite negative view about humanity, but please enlighten me, oh lawyer.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that the recorded information for evidentiary purposes, there really is, this trace is very significant, and there's a big difference between hearsay, and I heard this being said on the bus that someone expressed a negative sentiment about something, and the fact that they've got a Twitter feed that shows it periodically.
Do we need to get to a situation where we think about before we post? I mean,
that's very unlikely to happen, though.
I know. Well, technology, especially now with all mobile technology, is all geared up for instantaneous access, and frictionless sharing. Frictionless is such a horrible word, but that's basically what everything is designed for, to make it as easy to spit out what you're trying to say. But also that removes a barrier, a self-control barrier, perhaps. I mean, you know, when I look at my own Twitter feed, right, there are two sections to it. There's the bits that I feel have trouble keeping in, which are often ranty, and they come out probably without me thinking about it. But that happens, I don't know, once a month or something like that. And everything else is carefully thought about. You know, I consider it a conversation with the world. That's my view on Twitter, but many others don't. But that's because I think perhaps it's a unique perspective of a journalist, because you are constantly under the eye of the public for what you're writing about. Say if I say something that contravenes something I've written, perhaps, then that's a conflict there that somebody is likely to pick up on.
As always, these conversations about what we wish and what we wish to not be remembered end up in privacy. And with that, I'm going to suggest that we all pick up our quills and our scrolls and go back to the physical world. Apologies. Again, I sound a bit like a Luddite. But many thanks to my guests this week, to Lewis Dartnell, Julia Powles, and Samuel Gibbs. Thanks, too, to Helen Hochschuh. Remember, for breaking news day and night, tech news, that is, day and night, go to theguardian.com/technology. But for me, Alex Krotowski, and this week's Tech Weekly producers, Alana Chance and Jason Phipps, we're back next week. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.